You know, when you are living where I live and your only contact with Mr. Graham is turning on the television, seeing him in a crusade, sometimes you fail to realize that God not only has laid his hand upon Mr. Graham, but has somehow put together a magnificent group of men of talents that are so varied, but all dedicated to God, and that they are all a part of this contribution. Dr. John Wesley White is one of these men, associate evangelist with the Billy Graham Association since 1964. He is himself a matchless preacher of God's Word and conducts many crusades, not only in his native Canada, but in the United States. Of course, when he comes to West Texas, we have to get him an interpreter because he hasn't learned Texas English yet. He's a dear friend. I always look forward to his being on the program because on the morning he does the Bible study, he and I have breakfast together, and I pick his mind to get ideas. And this morning he called me at 6:30 and said, I can't be there. Dr. Graham had to talk with him a little while, and I was willing to let him go ahead and break that appointment. When you go back to the book room, and I want Dwayne Herb Branson to come in today sometime and talk to you, you'll notice his book, Reentry on the Second Coming. This is a book with a circulation now of almost 1 million copies. He's written extensively in the area of mission strategy. He's a PhD from Oxford University in England. Is now chancellor for Richmond College in Toronto. He's a great sports enthusiast, and sort of on the side, between everything else, coaches the hockey team, and right now is host of a very successful television series that is being shown on stations in Canada. He's a delightful human being, and we're so fortunate that he could take time out of a very busy schedule to come and be with us today in the school. John Wesley, come and lead us as we study God's Word.
Thank you, Dr. Chafin. I concede that I'm overwhelmed here in Texas. And Sunday morning, I was sent to preach in the First Methodist Church, which is the eighth largest Methodist church in the world and has the largest stained glass window in the Western Hemisphere. And after the 8:30 service, a huge Texan came up to me, and I mean, I had been reading that morning in the Avalanche, which was a thick newspaper, so thick that it's called the Avalanche, about grass that it grows as high as 100 feet. And then afterwards it said, that's bamboo grass. Well, I met this volume will not help to translate me. But this huge Texan came up to me and he kind of seized my hand. And he said, if that talk could be translated into Texan, it would possibly be a sermon. And so he wasn't sure because he hadn't understood enough to be certain. On Agape, our program across Canada, George Beverly Shea, who is also a Canadian, appears each week. And I have lived a great deal of my adult life in England, and I remember when the Billy Graham team first arrived. On the very first night, George Beverly Shea got up and sang that very, 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 very American gospel song, It Took a Miracle to Put the Stars in Place. And there was one very, 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 very English lady, far too English, chauvinistic before the women's lib ruined that word. And she had a flash of screaming red hair like the sunrise of this morning, which I reluctantly saw. And she sort of catapulted out of her seat and only touched down perhaps once between there and the long-aisled exit. And she seized this quill, out of this boiling, very English inkwell, and the blue stuff was just spraying from the quill as she stabbed it at this scroll, and she wrote a letter to Mr. Graham, one of the angriest he has ever received. And it said, "Dear Billy," and with the Billy, "Graham, you have the impertinence to come to our country at all and tell us how to live, let alone the audacity to put your singer up there to sing. It took America to put the stars in place." Can I tell them one more? I was with Mr. Graham in Belfast a couple of years ago, and my wife is from Belfast, and three of our four boys were born there, so we're sort of aware of what's going on. And I don't know whether I can tell this one and get the punchline or not, but please laugh, because I'm a very sensitive person. And after that statement on Sunday morning, I have suffered enough from the inferiority of my oratory. And he said that this Jewish man was walking down the street in Belfast, and all of a sudden, his worst prognostications were realized. Now, Mr. Graham didn't say that, so I've got to recruit that. A rifle barrel was in his ribs, and the man behind said, "What are you, Protestant or Catholic?" And he thought, well, if I say I'm Protestant, he'll perhaps be a Catholic and shoot me dead. And if I say that I'm a Catholic, perhaps he's a Protestant, and he'll shoot me dead. So I'll just tell him the truth. And he said, "I'm Jewish." And the guy shouted and said, "How lucky can you be? I'm Arab." Terribly touched that you should be that generous, because I haven't even got it myself yet. This morning from the 14th chapter of Matthew's Gospel, can we look at verse 35? And even if you, or that is, I could speak Texan, I don't know whether I could make enough noise. Out there last night, there was a locust behind the platform up in the television tower, and Ken, that locust must have been a Texan. He didn't need a public address system, and he was louder than Mr. Graham a couple of times, and it was the same guy that attacked Ethel Waters on Sunday night, wasn't it? And I got back to the room, and I saw that the film is being shown here, The Day of the Locust. And we had the night of the locust, and I hope this isn't the morning of the locust. Although I did see the headline in the sports page this morning that Big Bugs won the horse race. You are not as generous on that. So we shall go to the Bible immediately. From the 14th chapter of St. Matthew's Gospel, let's begin at verse 34. "And when they were gone over," that is the Sea of Galilee or Gennesaret, "they came into the land of Gennesaret. And when the men of that place had knowledge of him, they sent out into all that country round about, and brought unto him all that were diseased and besought him that they might only touch the hem of his garment, and as many as touched were made perfectly whole. And can we look at that verse 35? And when the men of that place, and of course this is the International Women's Year, and I think it would not be liberal liberty if I were to translate it people, so that it'll include the females. And when the people of that place had knowledge of him, Jesus, they sent out into all that country round about and brought unto him all that were diseased. Now I want us for a few moments to look at the woeful state of those who surrounded Jesus. As Mr. Graham said on Sunday night, is the world getting worse? Well, not so much the individuals in it as the corporate corruption, the totality of evil, because there are more people on the earth. And man's nature has never really changed. Only when Christ changes man's nature is man essentially transformed. So here we want to talk for a few moments about all that were diseased, woe. And I would like to suggest to you that then as now, people were, well, let's say they were helpless. They suffered from helplessness and from haplessness. And I have to think of this as a hockey coach. You kind of lay out the strategy and the tactics and get everything in order with your game plan. But the biggest job, at least in hockey, is to get a team psyched up and have enough hype. So let's say that the people in Jesus' day suffered from hypelessness. They couldn't get up. And finally, from hopelessness. And those are precisely, I suggest, the things from which the universal race suffers today. Let's think for a moment about that first one, helplessness. Jesus had just been on the Sea of Galilee walking across the water, and there was a turbulent storm, and the little vessel in which the disciples were to be found was bobbling about like a cork in a kettle. And then Jesus came, and he calmed the storm and said, "Peace, be still." And Peter got up over the edge of starboard and out, walked across the water, and he lost faith, and he sank. And a big, thirsty wave perhaps came up and bumped him in the chin, and he looked up, and he cried out to Jesus, "Help, save," because he was going down. And the human race is like that. It's going down. I'm a native of Saskatchewan, and I noticed that the editor of the Avalanche, or the president of the newspaper company, is Robert Norris. And he was describing what a delightful thing it is to get away from the pressures of life in Texas, and if the world is flat, to go very close to the edge and fish in Saskatchewan, and that's where I was born, very close to the edge. And we have a singer from there, Joni Mitchell, who is one of the three or four around the world who at the moment is in the bubble, and her song is Help Me, sort of a modern takeoff of what the Beatles had it going a decade ago. And their title was just Help. And that's sort of the universal cry of the human race. And this morning we have the assurance that we have not an high priest who who cannot be touched with the feelings of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly unto the throne of grace and obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. And often the psalmist spoke about the Lord being my help, my salvation. You see, in the face of temptation, we are helpless. St. Paul wrote about his retrospective Saul of Tarsus days when he said, "The good that I would, I do not, and the evil that I would not, that do I. Oh, wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from the body of this death?" And I noticed in the avalanche last night that the medical profession has four times as many chronic alcoholics as the rest of us succumb. And people who get rich, Texas is filled with tycoons, 22 times as many chronic alcoholics in that job, and 9 times as many among the actors and actresses. And the deaths from alcoholism has jumped into third place behind heart trouble and cancer. In other words, the 4 billion people around the planet Earth are facing a temptation, alcoholism, with which they can't cope. Take any of the vices or sins. We have had many political campaigns in Canada in which it was put forward very strongly that education would eliminate vice. But it hasn't done that. Last year, murder went up another 11.4% and rape 13%. And the last FBI release I saw in this country, it was for serious and violent crimes, 17% increase in 1 year, the worst since records have been kept. In other words, helpless. You pick up and read columns like Ann Landers. Of course, she's having her own problems this summer. But kids will write in. And one girl the other day wrote in and said, "I'm 18 years of age, and I love this guy who's impregnated me. He's 19. He's impregnated me 3 times. My problem is my parents. I've had 2 abortions. One, I was too late." And it was just taken for granted that she couldn't stop her sexing around. What was she to do? You say it's fulfilling, is it? Not when you read the suicide rates. The students come back up to Tech today, and Time magazine recently said that the highest reason for suicide among undergraduates is incapacity to cope with guilt over sex. We can't seem to adjust to the new mores. In other words, there's a helplessness in the face of sin. And you can go to any area of temptation. I feel helpless. That's the reason why the only cure that works is when the preacher gets up and opens the Bible and says that the angel requested Mary and Joseph, "Call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sin." And how long is it going to take us to realize neither is there salvation in any other, for there's none other name under heaven given among men whereby we must be saved? So those who surrounded Jesus were diseased with helplessness. Not only helplessness, but with helplessness, desperately unhappy. I suppose among the world's three or four best known and most celebrated females was a woman who was quoted in the Avalanche paper yesterday as saying that she's suffering from indescribable mental anguish. Desperately unhappy. Paul Newman's wife, beautiful actress, and I picked up a magazine in Pittsburgh Airport a while back, and she said, "I am so desperate for happiness that it seems that in the morning when I wake up, I can't even get out of bed. I wish Paul would take me out the back like an old mule and shoot me." Unhappy. Elvis Presley kind of flashed all 32 teeth out into the television cameras, and his mesmerized interviewer said, "Elvis, tell us, what is your prescription for happiness?" And the smile vanished, and he said, "Really, I'm not happy." He said, "I'm as lonely as hell." He went out onto the parking lot, as you saw in the paper the other day, and gave a $10,000 car away to a young woman who just happened to be looking into it. Not to make her happy, but to try to make himself happy. I suppose the most patrician political leader in the world scene today is the president of France, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing. And he was saying recently, "The whole world is unhappy. Happy because it doesn't know where it's going, and if it did, it would suspect that the direction would lead to disaster." I took my family to the CNE in Toronto the other day, and we were going through where all of the rides are. And I remembered my friend saying that he saw a woman in there, and she also had a flash of red hair and a diagonal snarl written across her face. And she had this little guy who was the definition of impossible. And he also had a snarl written across his face. And well, he might, because he had bugged her to bring him to the CNE and put him on the ride. So finally, he was just exasperating her, and she weaved her fingers through his hair, and she shook him like, you know, when you have that gallon of paint in the hardware and a guy puts the thing into the vibrator. And well, that's what she did to this little guy. And she just screamed at him, and there were hundreds of people around. She could have cared less. She said, "You bugged me to bring you here. And I've had you on the Ferris wheel, and I've had you on the roller coaster, and you've been on all these rides, and you're going to have a good time, even if it kills you. Do you understand?" And there are a lot of people who are doing anything and everything to have a good time, even if it kills them. Just what it's doing. Helpless, especially our young. Earlier this year, Fulton Sheen, whose integrity as well as intelligence I would be obliged to trust, made this staggering statement. He said, "Here in the United States, among the under 18-year-olds, suicide has doubled in the last 2 years. In just 2 years, it's doubled." And we turn to the scriptures and we read, "The way of the transgressor is hard." And Jesus, to Saul of Tarsus, "It's hard for thee to kick against the goad." And we realize what Shakespeare put into the lips of the young Hamlet. "Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt and resolve itself into a dew. Or that the everlasting had not fixed his canon against self-slaughter."
God, God, how weary, stale, flattened, unprofitable seem to me to be all the useless. Fie on it, fie on it. An unweeded garden that grows to seed things. Rank and gross in nature possess it, merely that it should come to this. What is a man if the chief good and market of his time be but to feed and sleep? A beast! People are feeling beastly today. We used to have a man around Oxford who was half American and half English, tried both worlds. T.S. Eliot, and he wrote, were the hollow men, stuffed men, headdress filled with straw. Alas, our dry voices, when we whisper together, are quiet and meaningless, like wind in the dry grass, like rat's feet over broken glass in our dry cellar. You see your great Shakespearean actor cover story on time, Richard Chamberlain, and he's grinning condescendingly, graciously, and the interviewer asks him about his happiness, and he says, "Mister, this is just an act. I'm an actor." He said, "I'm like that old song. I'm laughing on the outside, but crying on the inside." Sort of like the off-Broadway actor who said, "All this organized hilarity is driving me crazy." And what we need to do is to get back to Jesus, who said, "If you keep my commandments, you'll be happy." Maybe we need to suffer a little, like St. Peter said, "If any man suffer as a Christian, happy is he, for the Spirit of glory and of God is upon him." Our human race is diseased from haplessness and from hypelessness. It can't get up. Top of the Pops recently was a little girl called Carol singing, "Lift Me." And I noticed on a national television program, entertainment in this country, a man whose uncle was a devout Christian, and this man's very dissolute. And he had heard in childhood that song, "Love Lifted Me." So he just de-Jesus-ized it and sang it as a pop. "Love Lifted Me." Do you know why? Because people are down and they can't get up. One of the most relevant pictures of the gospel which you can enact Sunday by Sunday in your church is what Jesus so often did. He'd reach into a coffin and there'd be a corpse, a young man, and he'd say, "Young man, I say unto you, arise." And he was dead, he arose. And Paul said, "She that liveth in pleasure is dead while she lives." So Paul, "You hath he quickened who were dead in trespasses and in." And Sunday mornings, when you stand before your congregation, there are, if you preach to a few, there are several. If you preach to many, there are hundreds of people who are dead and need to rise to life. And they haven't got the psyche to get up. The reason why, we read in the Avalanche that there's a guy down here on the main street selling heroin packs for $70 a take. Why Mr. Graham told us on Sunday night that a youth took a last shot of horse and he's dead. Because kids are trying to get up. They want to take off. Anything that has a psychedelic or a hallucinogenic lift in it. Get me up off the floor. Like that pop song, "I'm turning gray from being blue." And what we need to do is affirm the gospel, which is good news. Hypelessness. Jesus again and again in his beatitude said, "Blessed," which means happy. And then hopelessness. And you hardly need this to be underscored. Huge headlines this morning about peace in the Middle East. But somehow we know that when they shall say peace, peace, then sudden destruction 30 years ago, yesterday, World War II ended. And that was to have been the war, according to your president, to end all wars. But each of us knows deep in our hearts that Jesus said, there shall be wars and rumors of wars. This will surround my coming, be a precursor, a harbinger. I know they advertise Rubber Ball here, saying, a time is coming when the existence of wars will cease, but there'll be Rubber Ball. Well, I suggest that Rubber Ball will cease. But the Bible says the wars are going to worsen. Peace, peace, sudden destruction. And we read in the Avalanche yesterday that you Americans have 7,000 nuclear-tipped missiles and bombs in Europe alone. Any scientist knows that one hydrogen bomb, let alone 7,000 in Europe alone, wrapped in cobalt and detonated in a strategic place, can annihilate 3 of the 4 billion humans on Earth. And somehow there's a hopelessness that reigns. We have preached in Protestantism rightly that we're saved by grace and that we're saved by faith. Did you know that St. Paul said we're saved by hope? And I was buying some groceries the other day, and the Reader's Digest repeated that familiar phrase. I was waiting in the queue, and I just picked it out of the stand and dropped it open, and there it was. In order to be happy, a human being has to have someone to love, something to do, and something to hope for. But we're living in a hopeless age. Jean-Paul Sartre, the French existentialist, has said again and again, there is no escape from the present despair. And as the chaplain of Princeton said this summer, it was across the country in the religious pages, if there's one word which describes the student world in the summer of 75, it is despair. Hopeless. St. Paul wrote from a jail. If a man is without God, he's without hope in the world. And Christ has come to bring us hope. So these people who were diseased with helplessness, haplessness, hypelessness, hopelessness, circulated around Jesus, and there was a magnetism to his personality. And when the men of that place had knowledge of Jesus, isn't that wonderful? Jesus said, it isn't what you do, for at the judgment some will come and say, have we not done many wonderful works? Of course, doing is the inevitable outcome of knowing. But making the effort to do without the knowing is futile. Depart from me, I never knew you. Well, these people knew Jesus. And they were enthralled with the experience. You know, all we have to do is to assert Christ to our generation. And some of us need to have that lesson reiterated every day that St. Paul affirmed to the Corinthians, or reaffirmed, I am determined not to know anything among you save Jesus Christ and Him crucified. Time magazine ran some time back that cover story on the 150 great men of Tamau, each of them under 45 years of age. I was not terribly impressed with their selection, at least of the Canadians they got in there. But there was one statement in there that struck me. It was by Adler, you know, one of the Freud young Adler troika. And Adler said, in order for a leader to be great, he has to have three things. And I wish you would, if you're taking any notes, just write these three things down. A man, to be a great leader, has to have three things. Now your ink is flowing. Write these. Ethos, logos, and pathos. And Adler defined ethos as to do with character, integrity, fidelity, honesty. Can he be trusted? That's ethos. And then there is logos. Has he got the intellectual apparatus to absorb, to accumulate, and the capacity of judgment to execute a plan, the mind? That is logos. And then, of course, pathos has to do with compassion, with empathy, with vicarious getting into the skull, getting under the skin of those whom you would seek to lead and influence. And when I read that article, I sat down with Dr. John Court, one of the best brains we have on the Billy Graham team, and we were eating breakfast. And we played a little game, like men sometimes will do. And we each turned our paper upside down and drew three columns and ran across the top, ethos, logos, and pathos.